Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
Live from Aspen Public Radio, I'm Allison Bektesh. This is Valley Roundup. This week, locals get a win in a fight against the development of new city offices. The Valley's solar industry, though, gets knocked by a charge by a tax change from the Trump administration. Also, how do mountain towns balance the preservation of open space with the need for affordable housing? And we take a trip to the edge of the earth. All that and more coming up on Valley Roundup. Joining me today to put all of this in context and give their insights are Christine Benedetti, editor of Aspen Magazine. Hi, Christine.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News. Hi, Curtis.
Hello. Good afternoon.
And Auden Schendler, author of Getting Green Done and a regular op-ed contributor to environmental issues. Auden, thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
All right, we're going to start with some quick hits of the week's news. Curtis, I'd like to start with you. The city of Aspen has hopes to build a new office building on Galena Plaza. Some locals are hoping that they don't. I want you to update us on what happened this week. I'm going to give a little background to this saga first.
Okay. Well, you want to give the background?
Sure. There was an idea that originally we were going to build this new, relatively large city hall in that place. It would house all government offices under one roof. It would also allow that power plant building and the armory where City Hall is right now to go to public use. Mm-hmm. There was a non-binding public vote that supported this. There were also threats of lawsuits at that time because that building was going to be too big. The city acknowledged that they were kind of worried about this being tied up in referendums or lawsuits and instead suggested a slightly smaller building at that same place, mm-hmm. keeping the armory to themselves. Turns out they got themselves a lawsuit anyway.
Right. Well, you had a really tortured process just to get to last April where you finally had a council vote in approval of a new municipal office building. And this plan, interestingly enough, has them keeping City Hall where City Hall is and then going and building what would be about a 37,000 square foot new office building that would be kind of by the library in between Galena Plaza and Rio Grande Park where the old Acra offices used to be. They want to redevelop that into this office structure. And, you know, from the beginning, you always face headwinds for any big development project of any kind in Aspen. Anytime it's the government, it adds a whole other element to it. And yeah, there's a faction in town that you just knew was going to challenge this in whatever way possible. They wanted to see it go to a public vote, which in a way makes sense because what don't we vote on here? We vote on buildings all the time. And so they went about it. Really, the thing about this story that just drives me insane is that these people who went to go do the petitions waited until literally the last day. You basically have 30 days.
Okay.
And it's even more than that because
arguably more than the last day.
And it's 30 days from when they publish the ordinance, which is actually a week, or it was even more. It was like 10 days after the actual vote in this case. So we're talking a month and a half here. And all you got to do is go out and get 640 signatures. It's a pretty low bar. And if you can get 640 valid signatures, you get to put things up for an election. Now, there's a whole other question of whether or not this is proper, if it's legally allowed, if it's legally referable, because of the type of decision it was. You can only refer certain council decisions to the voters, and that's a whole section of the law that's very complicated that very few people understand.
Is this Ref 1 or this is pre
that? It doesn't really have anything to do with Referendum 1 other than that it's the same people who are behind Referendum 1 who wanted to make it Referendum 1 made it so you had to have a vote on projects that did certain things that they saw as bad, which has the effect of shutting down those projects from ever coming forward. This is something that was coming forward regardless. It's city land. It's taxpayer money. It's a $22 million building. And But so kind of getting back to what I was saying, these guys waited until the absolute last minute, and the city felt that they had actually missed the deadline based on their reading of the law. And so they didn't even really accept the petition. They sort of saw it as moot. It was dead on arrival. Well, that led to this lawsuit. And really, the biggest effect of this lawsuit was the judge kind of threw out key portions of the city's motion to dismiss. You know, this lawsuit's filed. The city comes in and says, we think this should be thrown out on its face, and here's our reasons why. And the judge dismissed the city's motion to dismiss. Yeah, I'm clearly not a lawyer here. But so the judge basically said these guys did, in fact, the timing, they did not miss the deadline in the judge's opinion. And so now you kind of have to look at these other issues of the case. And those, in a lot of ways, this was just a battle in what's a longer war that you could say the city lost, but it's certainly going to continue.
So Toni Kronberg, who was kind of behind getting all those signatures, says she's overjoyed that the judge came down the way he did. But this is just setting up that ability to have a referendum, maybe, right? This isn't halting development of City Hall.
Right, and interestingly enough, it's been reported, it was reported in a follow-up story, and I confirmed this with the city yesterday as well, that they're planning to they're pulling like an electrical infrastructure permit. They're going to start demoing what's there in April, and this is the plan they've been working on since December. The council or the city attorney could probably put a stop to that if they felt like it, but things are well on their way, and really what's most interesting to me here is this question of whether or not we should have a vote on this at all. How it would go if you did have the vote.
The city thinks they know how it would go.
City staff has been very upfront in saying we don't really think we should have a vote on this because we don't think it's going to go our way because the public is not going to support a government building even if it is absolutely appropriate and necessary. The governments just don't win these votes, that there's a history of it, that other government organizations will avoid the vote if they ever can. And so that's kind of interesting to me. I wonder how I feel about that, especially since we do have a history of voting on buildings, but not everything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What do you guys think? Should we vote on this?
That sounds like a call out right there.
I'm reminded of the line from The Big Lebowski. Why does everything have to be a travesty with you, Walter?
Should we just put that on the sign on the way in?
Yeah, more Lebowski quotes, the better in government.
Another piece that came out in the Daily News this week was the local reaction to a federal change. The Trump administration has decided to up tariffs on incoming solar panels. So this affects our local environment industry. Those people who are trying to sell and install solar panels will now have to theoretically charge more for those services because they're buying those panels for a higher cost. Mm-hmm. And I would love to hear both of Auden and Curtis, your take on that.
Well, what's interesting here is that this goes against arguably everything Trump wants to do. There's a booming market for solar panels and for installation in the United States. And when you add this barrier to free markets, you reduce and prevent this trend that's been explosive, and it's a job creator. So it's wild. The thing I'd say is we think of the Trump administration as kind of bumbling and they don't know what they're doing, but they know exactly what they're doing in dismantling environmental regulation and in putting up barriers to progress on clean energy. The only reason that you would do this thing he's done on tariffs would be if you really, really wanted to support fossil fuels and really didn't like solar on their face. But if you cared about jobs and free markets and competition, mm-hmm. you'd let this thing run. And by the way, once you install solar, after it's paid off, it's free power. And that's why it's cheaper down the line. And even now, just up front, it's cheaper because you're not paying for fuel. So China's going to not pay for fuel and Americans mm-hmm. will pay for fuel.
And it's because of China has figured out a way to make this technology cheaper, faster. So the argument, I guess, would be, well, if we can't get it from other countries, we'll figure that out, too. We'll do a better job of creating our own solar industry within the country.
Yeah, is there a competitive American manufacturing industry for these things?
Yeah,
or do you have to go to... China? How does...
Well, there's merit to your point a little bit in that, hey, part of the reason the panels are cheap in China is their environmental regulations are less, right? So they're causing pollution and their labor's cheaper and so forth. So there are American solar panel manufacturers. SunPower is one. It's been doing great with... even with Chinese competition, because their panels are better and more efficient. So those are the boutique panels. You see them all over the valley. But the balance of people in the industry feel this has been a bad to maybe disastrous move.
Well, it seems like if you're making it harder for the consumer to acquire solar power, which seems to be that's what everyone is figuring is going to happen here, then yeah, you're hurting the public, driving the price up. Making it harder for our Valley solar companies to, you know, to compete.
You are listening to Valley Roundup, live from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh, and putting things in perspective for us today are Christine Benedetti, Curtis Wackerly, and Auden Schendler. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back, and thanks for tuning in to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. Auden, you had a piece that went kind of viral, at least locally, via social media that was published in Outside Magazine that came out this week, and also a story in the Daily News came out this week about the fact that you wrote that story. So I think we have a lot to discuss here. Your piece is titled How to Fix the Mountain Town Housing Crisis, and the very first setup that you have there relates it to our labor market as well. Can you start off with just talking about how housing and labor shortage are connected?
Well, the way I set it up was to say, you know, we had someone in one of our restaurants say, why aren't you composting? And we said, the person there at the time said, that takes labor, and we're short. Last winter, we were short 60 people in food and beverage.
Oh, over at Ski Company.
Yeah, and so, oh, composting is a labor problem. And then you're like, why do we have a labor problem? Because you hire people, and then they say, where am I going to stay? Well, you're going to stay in this mine dump with six other people who don't bathe. Ah, I'm going to go somewhere else. I'm not that core. So that's how I set it up. You know, the broad thesis is, if we follow the kind of operating principle that we've got to protect these wonderful, unique mountain communities by freezing them in time, we will destroy them. And the you know, Curtis was kind of riffing on the mentality that you don't build anything, you freeze the place, you don't develop, and that's true in basalt. And if you want to win a town council election, you say, small town character, and you've won, and that means you're not going to do anything. So
I will point out that you're on the town council in basalt.
Right. And I did not run
on that platform.
But so what's the solution? And what I'm saying is, hey, you don't have to build forever and just become New York City. You ought to be able to house your workforce. The way to do that is a combination of density in the core, not sprawl. And this wasn't, you know, to the extent that I got in arguments with people, they made the good point that it's not just density. It's deed restriction, so that the units don't just become wildly expensive and become second homes anyway, and other controls, incentives for affordable housing, that enable people to live there over the long term, transportation and so forth. So it's not just density. If it's just density, I understand that's not good enough. You have to have other interventions.
Well, I can't wait to talk with some of the city officials at our Aspen Town Hall coming up next week about some of those actual regulations that the city could put in place. So we could get into that a little bit. But I don't even understand the premise that density and environmentalists wouldn't be on the same side. Doesn't density help conserve energy, help conserve construction costs, and then also keep our open space open because we put all the housing in one spot instead of letting it spread out?
Anytime you want to jump in.
Ultimately, I think, but I mean, if we look at the example that just happened with Castle Creek, where City Council had the option to go for a more dense housing project. And there were some neighbors in the area that were against that. And so they chopped off the top floor of that affordable housing unit, ultimately costing our community 4 to 10 affordable housing or spaces for 4 to 10 employees to live here.
Curtis, that exact incident reminds me so much of the City Hall issue that we started the program with, because I feel like they downsized because they were afraid of a lawsuit. Same with the Castle Creek. They downsized, they took off a floor, and there's still a lawsuit going on there.
Well, you know, it's not so much this whole belief that's out there. It's not so much you can't ever build. It's like you can't ever increase the square footage. You can't ever increase the density because that's going to make the building bigger. It's going to mean there's going to be more people coming and going out of there who are going to have to park their cars or their bikes or their strollers or whatever. And it's going to be an inconvenience to somebody else. And it really is remarkable when you see just kind of naked self-interest play out, where it's like you just don't want to see this building that you might think is not attractive as you're driving up to your house further up the road, or you're not going to want to deal with a few more cars on the road, and that's going to impede your quality of life. I mean, I don't want to say there's not some real issues right here. There certainly are real quality of life issues we need to keep our eye on. But really, that's the argument here in a lot of cases is that this is going to impact me in a negative way. And we can debate whether or not that's even true. I think one of the points that Auden is trying to make is, look, like, there's going to have to be some amount of shared sacrifice. I mean, because to his point about the composting, what's happening now isn't really working.
Right.
You know, we're having a lot of problems with that. Like, that is causing a lot of quality of life problems as well. So we kind of have to look at this holistically and decide, you know, where we're willing to make trade-offs. And a lot of people would argue that a little bit bigger building with some more people living there who can afford to be a part of the community is a good trade-off to make if, you know, the parking's a little hectic.
We call that NIMBYism. And I don't know if you coined this term, but you end out your article with YIMBY instead, saying yes in my backyard. Auden, how do we get people to say yes?
Well, I didn't coin that, but it's a cool word for sure. And, you know, I was talking to someone in Basalt. Let me give you two examples of this. And they said, the person below me painted their roof white. I hate it. And painting your roof white is awesome. It reduces air conditioning. It makes your house and the town cooler. It's a good thing. So you should be able to deal with that. And then, another person in town on my street is a ski patroller and lives with a teacher. And they have a child. And this person petitioned to put an accessory dwelling unit on the house. And all the what would this do? It would provide affordable housing because it's a small unit. It would allow this beneficial family to the community live there because they make little money. All the neighbors came out against it. They didn't want the short-term construction, and they didn't want more traffic over the long term. That's wrong. And these were all really good people. So this is the kind of sacrifice I'm talking about. And, you know, what was really interesting, what's been interesting about the dialogue is it's been mostly civil and okay. It's been pretty thoughtful. One guy, he said, you know, this goes all the way back to Thoreau. And he cited a New Yorker magazine talking about how Thoreau environmentalism, old school environmentalism, I want to live alone. I don't want to see people. I want to be in the woods and I don't need society, is driving this. And if you look at the housing on Castle Creek, it's the same exact fight as Castle Creek Hydro. You know, it's I'm going to protect the environment in a pristine way, and I'm not paying attention to any of the modern issues, whether it's climate change or housing or the fact that things evolve or economies or what have you.
Christine, you're involved in the Next Generation Advisory Commission. Another thing that Auden's article said was, let's get young people civically engaged. How much would that change this conversation if we had more young leaders in the community?
I think immensely. I'm on Next Generation Advisory Commission, and we've been for several years under the impression that we can't build our way out of this affordable housing issue. And I think members of the board are starting to change that tune, realizing that we need to build more housing. There are not a lot of other solutions at this point. And so I believe the more people who are ultimately affected by this, which is our generation, need to come forward and petition for that.
Auden, do you have other ideas about getting young people involved?
Yeah, well, I think one of the most meaningful results of this conversation online has been that it has been quite civil. You know, I had a long-term local post that I was wrong and totally flame me while I was out to dinner. And when I came back, he had withdrawn the post and said, let's have a cup of coffee. Okay. And I said, absolutely. And you know what? I don't have all the answers. I'm not right. I'm so happy that this conversation is going on and that we can have it, and people can say, you're wrong here, but you have some good points there. So to me, that's the, you know, the younger generation that doesn't know anything. When you come on town council, you don't even know when you can talk or who you can talk to. Well, it's okay. Go bumble forward and people will be civil as long as you say, we're trying to improve this place. We're not, you know, we're not coming in from New Jersey and telling you what the answers are.
Unlike Auden Schindler.
Right, yeah.
I have another question for all three of you that I've been asking a lot of public officials recently, and it's this idea that if we build it, they will come. You know, we can't build our way out of this. No matter how much we build, more people will want to come. And the way you phrased it was, the goal isn't to let everyone in. Let's just talk about our current workforce and what we can do for them right now. Do you even believe that premise? Like, if we build a ton of new rental units, Curtis, will families from the Midwest quit their jobs, move their kids and their wife out, and try and look for work here because it's wonderful Aspen?
That's a tough question. You could certainly argue that if the cost of living in this community wasn't so high, there would be more people trying to come here. I mean, I think it's tough because the demand for labor in this community is so incredibly sky high. You could just build and build and build, and you're never going to meet it. The economy is going to continue to grow. It's going to continue to demand more workers. And so I almost feel like they're two separate questions in a way. Yeah.
And I'd love your take on that as well, Christine.
Well, I just think part of the conversation is that every city in America is also growing. So this isn't isolated to Aspen, even though we feel like it is. We like to feel like it is sometimes. And so that growth is happening everywhere, and we have to accept or figure out how to deal with it versus fighting it. And that, I think that it's an emotional issue.
So Curtis asked me in this article, what are good examples of smart growth in the Valley? And I was like, can't think of any. So part of the point is, hey, we haven't built optimal communities that house workers, that are walkable, that have mass transit access. We're doing a pretty good job, but we haven't done the perfect thing. My vision would be, do it, spend the next 20 years getting these communities to a really good level. And then if it's like, well, we can't deal, then you've done what you can. The other point is, you know, speaking for Aspen Skiing Company, if we get a ton more visitors over the next decade, we're not going to staff up that much. Hmm. We have a constant staff. Snowmass is fully staffed now, but it could take another couple hundred thousand visitors a year.
I see.
So we're not, like, there's not this growth machine other than construction, which is insane, but it's not going to go forever. So I do feel that you could achieve, you know, some high percentage of workforce housing.
I'm Allison Bechtesh. You are listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. Giving us the backstory today are Christine Benedetti, Curtis Wackerly, and Auden Schindler. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. Thanks for tuning in to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. We are live. And I have one of my guests today here, Christine Benedetti, fresh back from Antarctica, a 10-day trip. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, 10-day trip, 5 days in Antarctica, 5 on a boat to get there and get back.
And you were selected to attend this press trip that had a specific focus, right?
Yeah, so I work for Aspen Magazine. I'm the editor there, and my company, Modern Luxury, is based in Atlanta, so I went on to write a travel piece for all of the magazines in our company, and it was with a luxury travel line, cruise line, but it had a climate change theme. So we had scientists on board that were discussing the effects of climate change in Antarctica, as well as researchers in different areas of wildlife.
Does that mean they showed you the effects of climate change down there?
So I was expecting to see glaciers calving everywhere, having seen the same documentaries that you all have. And that wasn't necessarily the case. It's not like there's waterfalls everywhere and Antarctica is just melting. And we were there in the summer. But the effects are very, very noticeable and drastic. For example, we saw three different kinds of penguins there. And the Adelie penguins historically had been the main species of penguins in the part of Antarctica where we were. And they no longer exist there. We saw two of them, maybe out of the thousands of penguins that we saw. They've all moved south where it's colder.
Did you have a question you want to ask?
Well, you know, Trump in his State of the Union said, he said, yeah, the ice caps are at record levels. He's right. The Arctic is gone. It's at the absolute lowest it's been ever. I mean, it's almost summer sea ice in the Arctic is going away in the next decade. Did you hear from scientists what's happening in the South?
So, yeah, a couple years ago, they actually had one of their larger ice years. And I think that that's probably attributed to different weather effects around the globe. That doesn't necessarily mean that Antarctica is growing. It is shrinking. And several scientists who've spent decades there could point to a glacier and say, when I was here 30 years ago, this was out to here, and now it's retreated a half mile.
Anytime someone points to a singular weather event as evidence for or against climate change, is that always strains
kind of me. Inherently shows yeah. that they don't understand the concept.
Like, right. Yeah, I mean,
it's snow today.
Yeah,
climate change is over.
When we're talking about patterns, that's one thing. But again, Trump, when he's like, "Oh, it's so cold." Global warming is obviously crap.
Was there anything that surprised you? I mean, you have these pictures in your mind from seeing it from film and all that, but were there moments where you're like, "I had no idea it was like that"?
There were two things that were really surprising to me. We were on the Antarctic Peninsula, which is essentially an extension of the Andes that's now mostly underwater. So the mountains were incredible. And I thought of Antarctica as sort of a flat tundra.
Yeah.
And then we were surrounded by 6,000 and 9,000 foot peaks. So as someone who lived in the mountains, it felt almost like home, except for being surrounded by water. You know, it's hard to not want to just get out and ski it and hike it. And the other part of that was that the Antarctica is actually what they consider a desert, even though it's frozen. It's the central part of Antarctica has taken millions of years to form, so it snows an inch or two every year, and then that's been packed down into an ice layer, which is different from the Arctic. So there are a lot of differences. And the real precipitation happens out on the peninsula, but the actual continent of Antarctica is very dry. So retreating ice and losing that ice is not something that can be grown back in a couple years. I mean, we're talking about the history of the Earth here. So
The other thing I have a question about, since this was like a cruise line from the south of Argentina over to there, but should people see this, or should we stay away because that kind of creates the environment problems that we're talking about?
I mean, it's pretty incredible to see. So if you have the chance, I would say go. That said, it's also pretty restricted. You have to go on a mission of science or research. And so they're doing a good job of monitoring how people are getting down there and what they're doing when they're there. It's considered a pristine environment. So you're actually not spending any time on the continent besides a little walkabout. The rest of the time is spent on your boat.
Are you in like a booted up suit so you're not like contaminating it?
Yeah, you wear these neoprene boots and pants, and you spray off every time you go on, spray off every time you come back onto the boat.
It's like you went into outer space.
Kind of. Cold. Yeah.
How cold is it or warm in an Antarctic summer?
That's been a lot of people's most popular question, and it's their summer, so it was 35 to 40 degrees most of the time, and it was sunny the whole time. Sunny or light. I mean, the sun set, but it was really just twilight. So it stayed about the same temperature the whole time.
And we're going to have to cut it off right there. Thanks so much for tuning in to Valley Roundup, live on Aspen Public Radio. Today, my guests are Christine Benedetti, editor of Aspen Magazine, Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, and Auden Schendler, among other things, the author of Getting Green Done. You can get a rundown of links and more information on the stories we covered on the show on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, serving the Roaring Fork Valley since 1953. Balcom & Green has been recognized for professional excellence by U.S. News on its best law firms list. More information at 945-6546. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale.